I'd like to welcome Steve Shane. Steve was born in Camden, New Jersey, back in 1954. He graduated from Cornell in 1977 with a B.S. in floriculture and ornamental horticulture. Growing up, his Aunt Anne had a hat store in Englewood, New Jersey, with a large Singer sewing machine. Steve moved to Petaluma in 1983 to work in the San Francisco wholesale flower market. Basic sewing was born about 5 years ago when his girlfriend wanted some denim bags made. Since then, he's been gaining experience by buying and selling sewing machines of all types. He has gained knowledge of various needle types, threads, feeds, materials, leather, and design awareness. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Andrea. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so why don't you tell us about basic sewing?
First of all, I want to give a shout out to my parents, Ira and Sylvia. Hopefully, if my dad got his computer figured out, they're listening in northern New Jersey.
Oh, excellent. Yay.
Hello, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Basic sewing, it kind of relates to what you were describing earlier, a one person show. I've always been interested in mechanics of all kinds. As a kid, I took apart my train sets and all that. And for some reason, the sewing thing was always in the back of my mind. In the late 70s, a friend John in Tucson, Arizona, had a shoe repair shop. And that got me interested in the shoe thing. But this, and it kind of planted a seed of always wanting to make shoes. And eventually I realized that to make shoes, I needed to learn how to sew.
Right.
So I basically had to teach myself how to sew and what the sewing machine was all about and what the stitch was all about. And from there, it's kind of blossomed into a bedroom business of a sort.
I like that. Well, I mean, so how exactly did you learn how to sew? I mean, did you get books? Did you just, like, spend a lot of time with the machine? Or?
Through the years, I had various machines, but I could never get them to stitch right. Mm-hmm. You know, when my friend John had the sewing machine at the shoe repair shop, a little later, I bought a shoe repair machine and tried to figure it out, and I couldn't. And eventually, I just let it go. I had to sell it. So it got too frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
But then eventually I, through asking people and through these days through a lot of YouTube videos and actually buying a machine and seeing how the lock stitch worked. I mean, how was the stitch actually formed? And I really had to look at that and see the mechanics of it and basically look at the design of a sewing machine and go back to Isaac Singer and the people that and how who actually initially designed the sewing machine in the early 19th century.
Wow. I mean, that's like kind of getting to like the anatomy of sewing. You know, like I don't think I've done a little tiny bit of sewing mm-hmm. on a machine and I don't think I've ever, you know, it's like I, you know, push the pedal and it sews something and
right.
I don't think I've ever thought about the different stitches.
Yeah, I basically had to teach myself. I mean, hand stitching is one thing, but a lot of hand stitching is just done with one thread. Like in and out in a material to join two pieces of material together. And the early sewing machines, what the big revelation was a lock stitch, where there's a top thread and a bottom thread, and they actually interact.
Is that so? Like the the bobbin.
That's the bottom thread.
The bottom thread, right? And so the top thread and the bottom thread is called the lock stitch.
Yes, their interaction.
I did not realize that.
And I'm not sure if Isaac Singer actually came up with it, but the main revelation at that point was the fact that the eye of the needle, where the thread goes through, was near the point in machines. Previous to that, it's like hand stitching, where the point of the needle is at one end and the eye of the needle is at the other. But he figured out that when the eye is at the bottom near the point, a hook from the bottom, which the bobbin is kind of attached to, can hook around the top thread and form the lock stitch.
And why is the lock stitch important? What makes it great?
Previously, if it's just a one stitch, it's usually a chain stitch, and it can just pull apart. It's just one thread, so that by tugging on it, you can just pull out all the work. But a lock stitch, they actually interlock. There's a top, you know, top and a bottom, and they mm-hmm. hook each other, and it's much stronger.
Oh yeah,
basically
right.
The strength of the stitch because it's two threads.
That does make a lot of sense. So what's the, like, kind of on a basic level, like, what's the difference between sewing and fabrication?
I love that basic word. let's see. Fabrication involves the design first. And coming up with an idea, and then usually a drawing is after that, or sometimes even a pattern. And then becomes the fabrication, and sewing is actually part of the fabrication aspect of it. So you need an idea and a design, before you can fabricate something.
Oh, I see. So it's kind of like the planning aspect.
Right.
Before you actually do the action of sewing?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I mean, you can sew on the fly as well, but a lot of times you'll take a lot of different trials and errors before you get to something.
Yeah. So how, like, on the fabrication end of it, like, how long does it take, you know, that process to do, you know, like, what kind of amount of work does it take before you can actually get in front of the machine and start sewing?
Well, what comes to mind is a recent project where I did, a guy came to me through a referral who is a contractor, and he had a small leather bag that he loved. He put his camera in it and his wallet in it, and he threw it under the truck of his seat, but mm-hmm. It was all worn out. So he wanted another one. So basically, in that situation, there was an existing pattern. So I could take apart what was worn out on the old one and make patterns and then fabricate a new one out of it. But basically that was part of the fabrication. The design was already there.
Right.
Rather than an initial design or unique original design.
Interesting.
So it was a lot easier in that process. I brought a sample of my work, these sandals that I know the radio can't see. But anyways, these are based on an existing pair of sandals that I used as a pattern as well. This particular guy had polio as a kid, so his feet are two different feet, and an existing pattern was there, so I could fabricate, you know, use that as do some measurements and make some samples out of that.
Yeah, the sandals look great. They're a brown leather, and is that Velcro for both over what would go over like the top of the foot and then also around the ankle?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was a modified, based on what he already had. We came up with an idea together. So basically by working with the client, I could come up with a fabrication idea and a design idea that worked for him.
What kind of, so there was like a basic, a sandal that he already had?
Yeah, he had some custom sandals made about 30 years ago.
And what was the change that he, other than just a new pair?
They were worn out. And the ankle attachment was unique to these. Previously, it was just like a strap around the back of his ankle, and he needed a little more security.
Yeah, that looks like a lot of support because it's a very wide band that would go around the ankle.
Exactly. So by working with him, I could come up with an idea.
So what types of machines do you use?
At this point, I'm a little embarrassed to say I have a collection of maybe 20 or 25 different machines.
Really? That's a lot.
But I only pretty much use 5 or 6, something like that. And one of my favorite machines is it's called a cylinder arm machine, and it's a treadle. It's a Pfaff treadle.
Explain what that is.
So the cylinder arm means it's hard to describe, but, most sewing machines are a flat table machine. So there's a flat table that the bobbin is under the flatness of the table. Mm-hmm. In a cylinder arm machine, there's a cylinder, about a 2-inch diameter cylinder that floats in space. So the bobbin and the hook, which is part of the bobbin, are in space so that you have a lot of free access.
Wow. So how is, for, again, like someone like me that's only, you know, used a sewing machine to like go forward and backwards on like cotton or something, mm-hmm. you know, what can you do with a float where the bobbin is floating compared to where it's stationary on like a regular home sewing machine?
You just have access. I mean, think of a long sleeve shirt.
Mm-hmm.
To sew a long sleeve shirt on a flatbed machine, you'd have to take off one of the seams to get access to like the inside of it or maybe where the elbow is.
Oh.
On a cylinder arm machine, you could slip it over the cylinder and then have access to like the elbow to put a patch on or something like that.
Oh, excellent.
So
yeah,
basically all sewing machines have the top and the bottom, and the bottom is the bobbin and the hook. But there's different configurations of that, cylinder arm or post bed or what are some of the others? And there's different stitches as well. I mean, different feed mechanisms as well. There's walking feet or bottom feed or needle feed. And it's just a learning curve that I've had to kind of sort through and figure out what I need and what I want and what I can afford and actually what I have room for in my little sewing room.
And does some of, like, the different you know, like the different aspects of the machine. Is some of it different because it is what the machine is meant to be used for, or is it a brand thing? Like Singer does this, and Brother Sewing Machine uses this other one.
No, it really has nothing to do with the brand. Maybe initially certain brands had patents on different designs, but at this point, it's basically the size of the machine, the size of the needle, the size of the thread you can use in that machine, the length of the stitch, and the design of the machine itself for access. I mean, my goal has been to make shoes, so I've had to kind of specialize in a couple different machines that are heavy duty. And I didn't want to make a big investment financially, so I basically had to pick and choose and kind of adapt a couple machines.
Yeah. Now, with these machines, are they new machines, or are they more historical? I don't want to say antique.
Well, the cylinder arm I mentioned earlier, I haven't really been able to date it. It's probably the early 40s or maybe the late 30s.
Oh, wow.
And it's still a treadle machine. So
and what's a treadle again?
Treadle is the foot pedal. It's not electric.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it gives you a lot of control.
Yeah.
Which I really like about it.
Yeah, it's like a real real wide, like, cast iron.
Yeah, like the cylinder, I think, is about 18 inches from the right base of the machine, and it's about 2 inches in diameter.
Yeah.
And one of my other machines, my big harness machine, I actually took the motor off of it because it was just too fast. It's a big, heavy-duty machine, and the needle is like a large hypodermic needle.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was just afraid that it might go through a finger.
Yeah, I would be, too. Well, you know, I never thought about this before, but it kind of reminds me, like, the electric versus, like, the foot-powered, which I feel like you don't see a ton of the foot-powered machines being used anymore. But it's similar to, like, with ceramics, where you have a wheel that is, like, an electric pedal, or you have a kick wheel, and how it's to go from one to the other is very different techniques that you would use, because to be able to, like, speed up and slow down and at how fast and all that.
Exactly. I mean, one of my first machines were electric machines, and then I realized that I wanted more control, and I got more specialized.
Yeah.
And that's when the Pfaff treadle machine came into my life, and a couple other machines.
Because even with the foot power, I mean, it's such an ingenious design, because it doesn't really take that much. I mean, it goes really fast.
Mm-hmm.
Still.
I think
people have this idea of, like, you know, electric versus foot power, that the foot power is going to be slower.
It's not necessarily slower, but for what I'm doing, there aren't real long expanses of stitches. So it's not like I have a mile worth of stitches to feed through the machine. Basically, what I'm doing is maybe a foot or two at a time at the most.
So, when you're making the shoes?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so it's kind of a short run.
Exactly.
You're just going through
really
quick.
Exactly. And at this point, I've gotten more and more familiar with machines. I'm starting to buy and sell machines.
Oh, really?
Like, buy one and then see if I need any parts, or see how I can fix it up, or kind of upgrade my own collection and selection.
And, like, where do you find these sewing machines?
For the most part, either eBay or Craigslist.
Oh, really?
Or word of mouth at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been fortunate in the North Bay area and Sonoma and Cotati and even Sebastopol to meet different shoemakers and people that are doing shoe repair that have inspired and mentored and encouraged. In Sonoma, Jessica at Large Leather has been real helpful. And,
oh, yeah, she's great.
And Fran at the Sandal Lady in Cotati, she does baseball glove repair. She's been real inspirational. Michael at Apple Cobbler in Sebastopol, and Misak at the shoe repair shop in Mill Valley. He let me intern there for about a year. So I was going there Wednesday afternoons for a year, just to, you know, not unpaid position, but he let me be there and I could learn and see how shoes were made, what he did to repair them, and gain experience.
That's kind of surprising that that's more than I thought that we had in the region, like, shoemaker wise.
Well, they're not all makers. These are leather people.
Leather goods. Okay.
Yeah, leather is what they have in common. Michael in Sebastopol is, I think, the only bootmaker that I know of around. But, you know, I know most of the shoe repair people and some of the leather suppliers.
So before the break, we were talking about the different machines that you use in your sewing and fabrication business. And I was wondering what other tools do you use that aren't the sewing machines?
All kinds of hand tools. I mean, a rotary cutter to cut the leather, different awls, different hammers, different sets to set different snaps and eyelets and grommets. Basically the sewing machine itself is just like a mechanized version of a needle and thread and an awl.
Right.
I mean, originally the shoemaker just used an awl and some needles. And did you know that the sewing machine was the first thing you could buy on credit?
Really?
In the mid-19th century, sewing machines had showrooms like car showrooms now.
Ooh, so fancy and shiny.
Exactly.
And,
yeah. Exactly. When a new machine came out, everyone went down to the showroom and put some money down.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's a big machine. I mean, in all sense, like the older ones, particularly the amount of metal that's in them and how heavy they are and all
right,
the little mechanics.
But just imagine in the early days, you'd be needling a thread and all of a sudden a sewing machine is available.
Yeah.
And you could do, you know, in 5 minutes what used to take a couple hours. The other thing I wanted to mention was the reason the Baseball Hall of Fame is in Cooperstown is because Singer came from Cooperstown.
Oh, really?
And one of the early Singer family members donated the money to start the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Well, they probably did a lot of work in the baseball gloves.
Could be.
Maybe. No.
Could be.
Possibly.
I don't know.
Well, like, what are the different types of materials that you work with?
At this point, I'm working with leather, and mm-hmm. I'm really intrigued with horsehide.
Oh, interesting.
And most people use cowhide or other types of leather, but for me, the horsehide is the most durable. And I don't know, it's interesting how people react to it. They look like horse and they turn up their nose and.
Cause it's a pet.
Yeah,
is that,
or something.
Yeah,
it's
probably,
like,
yeah.
It's like Mr. Ed or Flicka or something.
But what, like, have you, you know, how does the horse leather react differently than the cow leather, for example?
Well, they don't react differently. It's just in terms of the strength and the appearance.
Oh, okay.
To me is real important. And I'm also interested in exploring other materials. You know, I have this fantasy of using this type of outdoor carpeting for shoes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I haven't been able to track a picture of it down yet, but at one point I went up to Niagara Falls, which is where my mom is from. And when you went to the Cave of the Winds, which is like this incredible myriad of wooden decks underneath the falls,
mm-hmm.
they gave you these shoes to wear, basically moccasin kind of things, but they were made of like indoor-outdoor carpeting.
Oh, that's so interesting.
So they could get wet and dry out real fast. And I thought about, why couldn't some of that be used for shoes? Or
right.
Or some type of moccasin or like an indoor-outdoor shoe.
Yeah, because isn't that indoor-outdoor carpet, it's kind of like it's got like a rubber base to it.
Some of it does. Some of it does, yeah. Yeah, so I'm interested in other materials. I mean, now that I've gotten a lot real familiar with the sewing aspect, the attaching the materials and some of the different glues involved and the process, it's like, why not use something other than leather?
Yeah.
I mean, some people have an aversion to leather, vegans or you know, by personal choice. And I'm open to that. You know, at this point, I'm interested in making shoes. And the easiest way, similar to the bag I mentioned earlier and these moccasins that are here, is to have an existing design and then copy it with other materials or different colors or different thread sizes or you know, there's a lot of variations.
Well, with this idea of trying other materials, like, what are you looking for in a material? Like, what attributes would interest you in a material?
I think texture and color.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm an artist. I'm a musician, and color and texture have always been interesting to me.
Well, yeah, how did you come up with the business name Basic Sewing?
Well, some people look at my business card and they say I spelled basic wrong.
Well, it's a beautiful, I have to say, it's a beautiful yeah. business card because I enjoy that it is both visually really nice, it's very clean, black and white, but then it has a texture to it because you sewed around the edge of the card, right?
Yeah, it's sewn on the outside of the card. The outside border is done with that Pfaff cylinder arm treadle machine I mentioned earlier. And it's designed by my friend Tina Tubby, who lives here in Sonoma.
Nice.
But the basic idea, I've been playing bass since I was 9 years old, the string bass. And something about that, the phonetics of the basic and the basic have always intrigued me. So why not Basic Sewing? And on the card, I spelled it B-A-S-S-I-C, but I put a long line over the A to make it, you know, people know that it's not Bassic, it's not a fish or something.
And, helps with the pronunciation.
And the card also has the bass clef to the left. So there's this other messaging there that some people get if they're musical and some people don't, and that's fine too.
Well, I like it because it really has a, it has a nice identity to it, mm-hmm. you know, both on the verbal that you hear it, like basic, so like, mm-hmm. and then also on the visual of seeing it. Mm-hmm. So, are you still actively playing music?
Oh yes. Yes. Last year I celebrated 50 years of playing the string bass.
Wow.
And altered context and whatever. And I wanted to mention that I'm going to be part of the Petaluma Poetry Walk this Sunday from 6 to 8 at the Aquas Cafe, which is the Foundry Wharf, 189 H Street in downtown Petaluma. But previous to that, there's all kinds of different events. I think there's 6 or 7 different venues in Petaluma.
Oh, that's fun.
So you can spend all Sunday walking around and hear different poets at different venues. And I think it's PetalumaPoetryWalk.org is the website for people to get some information.
Excellent. I mean, that kind of seems like a nice, you know, kind of range to have the sewing, which I feel like has like so much rhythm to it when you're using a sewing machine, and then also have the music.
Definitely. Yeah, I really appreciate that, the rhythm and the sound of the, some of the machines, especially the treadle machine, like late at night when everything else is quiet.
What kind of sound does it make?
It's just quiet and rhythmic, and it's just doing its job. You know, it's not offensive. You don't have to plug it in.
Mm-hmm.
You can have the lights down low or whatever, and just have a light on the work and the needle. And it's under human power.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that aspect.
Well, how has music influenced your sewing?
I don't know. I'd have to think about that. It's very rhythmic. Very rhythmic. And it's like construction, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been playing bass for a long time, and I consider myself an improviser. You know, I have played in orchestras and jazz trios and that kind of thing. But for the most part, I feel like I'm at home playing with dancers and with poets. And rhythm is definitely part of that. And the stitch, there's nothing like a straight stitch on a sewing machine. I mean, it's solid rhythm.
Yeah. Do you think maybe like sometimes when you're, since you have so many different machines and that you're, you know, trying them out and stuff, would you maybe like pick a machine over another one because it makes a better sound? Or, like, has a better, like, feeling to the rhythm?
Definitely. I mean, but when the stitch is right, it you can hear it almost.
Oh, really?
You know, it's not just a visual thing. Yeah, and at this point, I'm fixing up two different hand-powered machines for my friend Daniel, who's kind of a back-to-the-lander guy,
mm-hmm.
wants to get off the grid, and he wants 2 hand-powered machines. So they're just basically cranks on different machines. Not like a whole metal treadle bass with mm-hmm. foot power. These are hand powered.
Oh, interesting. So how does that work?
There's a hand crank attachment that fits on the flywheel.
Hmm. And so you just like crank it up and then.
Yeah. Well, you have to crank it as you go. It's not like a spring wound.
Okay, that's it. Yeah, that was my question.
No. It's you have to crank it as you go.
Yeah. So. Like, a lot of what you've been talking about with, the using, like, the non-electric machines or repurposing, you know, materials, like, to me, like, really comes off as, you know, like, kind of a lot of sustainability aspects to the
mm-hmm.
business.
Mm-hmm.
Is that purposeful?
It's not overt, but it definitely is when I look at it. I mean, mm-hmm. in college, I don't remember what he said, but I remember being at a talk by E.F. Schumacher, who wrote a book called Small is Beautiful in mid-70s. And that was an influence. It was an inspiration, you know, to be small, to be sustainable, and everyone has to have shoes and clothing. So why not, you know, why not try to make your own?
Yeah, yeah. Are there any, you know, are there anything that you're in your business, you're striving to become more sustainable, or maybe, you know, that you're looking at like how you're currently doing it and you'd like to improve it in a sustainable way?
To be honest with you, what I'm trying to work on is my work ethic.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. A lot of me just wants to pick up the bass and play and not do the sewing that's required or that the work that's on the table.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm working on that one.
That's definitely sustainability right there, right?
Exactly.
You got to be able to do the work to stay in business.
Yes. And at this point, I've made, you know, done a lot of repairs, and what I'm looking at is my first pair of sandals for a custom order. And my next goal is to make a pair for myself so that I'm wearing my own shoes. That hasn't happened yet.
Oh, yeah.
So that's my next goal, is to make a pair that I can wear on my own and try it out as a test and get some feedback from people.
Yeah. So what kind of repairs have you done?
All kinds of anything to be sewn. You know, one of the recent things, a woman called me up who's the director of a health club in Petaluma, and they had an Everlast punching bag that someone had punched through.
Oh, wow. Someone got strong.
Yeah, or kicked through. I'm not sure what happened, but there was a big rip in the leather. And she asked me if I could fix it, and I did. But, you know, I had to redesign it a little bit to reinforce it, because the original construction obviously had failed. So that was a major repair. And to me, it's exciting to look at something, how it was constructed originally, and how I can make it stronger or more aesthetically pleasing.
What's the most, like, kind of common repair job that you'll get?
Actually, lately I've been repairing handles on ladies' purses.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like redoing the leather. Because a lot of people, I guess, they have a purse they really like, or even zipper repair.
Mm-hmm.
That's similar on purses. But I can, you know, I have a big leather selection now that I can choose either a contrasting color or a similar texture or similar weight. And, you know, basically get their treasured possession back in their hands.
That's great, because it's kind of like the handle or piece like that. It's what gets used, like it has the most wear and tear, but the rest of the piece might still be totally fine.
Exactly. And a lot of times I'll get something that someone, you know, says they really love, and you can obviously see where other people have repaired it in the past.
Oh, really?
So then I have to really think about what I'm doing to it, and is it some heirloom that I don't want to mess with too much, or do I want to just take off all the old stuff and redo it, or... So basically there's some thought process involved, and I appreciate that aspect.
Yeah. Well, you repaired a jacket for me that was... I mean, like, I had this little blazer that I found at a yard sale years ago that, you know, I could see that people had repaired at various times.
Mm-hmm.
And in the winter, it's what I wear, like, all the time. And it has a lining, and the lining ripped, and I was just like, I do not know how to fix that at all. And now, is that one of the instances where you were talking about the floating bobbin, how you can, like, get where you would use to be able to get in and repair a bigger piece, like a jacket?
Well, with a cylinder machine, this particular one and a lot of others, you have an option of putting a flat table on it. So you can make it into a flat table machine with, like, a wooden attachment that goes around the floating cylinder arm. But a lot of the flatbed machines, you can't go the other way around. You can't turn a flatbed into a cylinder arm.
Right.
So with that one, yeah, with the jacket or similar things, that's why I like the cylinder arm. It gives you a lot of access.
Yeah. Well, and it's something like, as like, you know, someone like me that doesn't, you know, have that many skills or like has a very simple machine, it's like I look at it and I'm like, how am I going to, I can't fit it, you know. And so it's great to know someone that has like the proper tools to do the job.
Yeah, well, that's why I've had to acquire the machines to basically see what they do, because it's like knowledge that isn't readily available. I mean, even with the internet or something, for me, I need to be hands on.
Yeah.
So I bought a couple machines just to see how they work.
And then you decide that you don't.
Yeah, I don't need it, or you know, it was intriguing, but or I'll pass it on, or. Or we'll see what happens to it. Right now, you know, I have a bunch in storage that are just kind of waiting for the next owner.
Yeah. I think that's so wonderful about sewing machines, how, like, they do have multiple owners and that they have, like, a real longevity to their life.
Oh, certainly. Certain models these days have almost cult followings.
Oh, really?
There's a Singer Featherweight that's a small machine that I don't really understand why, but for some reason they go for hundreds of dollars.
And like when was it made? Kind of.
They were made, I think, from the 30s, maybe till late 50s, something like that. But there's different colors and different models, and certain ones are highly collectible. And there's different websites totally dedicated to them.
Wow.
You know, so it's interesting how, you know, it's and a lot of times it becomes much more than just a functional machine.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes like an heirloom or something.
Yeah. Well, and they get passed down.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I even grew up, I mean, the sewing machine that I learned how to use was just a Singer, and it could go forward and backwards. That's all, like, in one stitch. Mm-hmm. So to see some of these more modern sewing machines with all these different stitches, I'm like, I don't know. All I want to do is, like, sew forward and backwards.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the early machines didn't even have backwards.
Right.
Just one direction.
Yeah.
And I have, I think, one machine that has zigzag. That's about as advanced as I get.
Yeah.
So, yeah, most of my machines are, they're older, you know, Singer, probably, I think the oldest one is 1899.
Wow.
But most of them are newer, 50s and 60s, yeah. Something like that. But they're functional. I mean, they're basically, it's a machine that's made to do a lock stitch in different configurations.
And, like, with these older machines, what kind of maintenance do they need?
A lot of times it's just oiling.
Wow.
And, you know, that's basically part of my learning curve is teaching myself how to, you know, how does the hook come around to make the stitch?
Mm-hmm.
So that if you have a machine that's skipping stitches, you know, what does that mean? Is it the upper tension? Is it the lower tension? Is it the timing? You know, the possibilities.
Oh, right. Rather than
taking it, I mean, you know, one or two of the machines weigh like 50, 75 pounds, so I don't want to be dragging it to a repair guy or having him make a house call.
Yeah.
So it's been interesting, the whole, you know, teaching myself basically what to do with the machines. And now that I know that, I can help other people.
That's wonderful. Okay, before the break, we were talking about using the different machines and repairs, and but I was wondering, like, what goes into your, like, design process when you're designing a piece?
Well, for me, design is like down the line. I'm learning design. It seems like I've taught myself what the machines will and won't do, what sizes the thread and needles and all that. And the design is, like, new to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at different magazines, different fashion magazines, to see what people like. But my inherent aesthetic is a very simple, you know, comfort level. And I want to design a shoe that's comfortable more than anything, not a high fashion something. I mean, that's a custom something that's kind of out of my level right now. But I'm envisioning something like a simple boot from like L.L. Bean or maybe Clark's or something like that. Use these time-tested designs rather than trying to redesign the wheel. But use different materials and different colors to personalize it.
I like that because it's also, I think it, all the things that you've been talking about today, it really kind of fits into this, kind of unitary, utilitarian, you know, kind of work, you know, stuff that has a purpose, you know, and that you can use it for that and, you know, it's more of a, like a work shoe or something, you know.
Yeah, just you mentioning that, I pictured, some of Van Gogh's drawings and I think a couple paintings of his boots. And they're just these totally functional work boots that just look so elegant.
Yeah.
That timeless design. So the design is a given, but then what about the craftsmanship? You know, that's what I want to concentrate on. Maybe use an existing design, but craft it in my own personal way.
I love that because, you know, as someone that does, you know, physical work, I think you start to really look at your garments and your shoes, and, you know, like, it just wears quicker, you know, because you're really, you know, putting your garments to work, and so you get frustrated and you're like, oh, I just want to, you know, have a pair of shoes that'll last a season, or, you know, I want to have pants that don't, you know, constantly have holes in my knees, you know, from doing the farm work, and so it's like the craftsmanship really starts to become important, I think, for what I look at buying.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm 6'5" tall, and I wear a size 14 shoe.
Not many of those in the store.
So it's been hard to find the shoes that I like, and when I do, I'd have to order them through a catalog or something and get them, and they didn't quite fit right or something was wrong with them. So I think that was what maybe initiated some of the shoe interest for me personally.
Right, to be able to get the shoes that you want to wear.
Right, exactly.
So how do you make a shoe? Because that to me just seems like, I get making clothes, but like shoes just seem like there's so many elements to them.
what goes back to what we mentioned earlier about the fabrication and how it has to start with the design and then have a pattern. And a shoe is usually built on a last, which is a wooden form that's basically a copy of your foot.
Ooh.
So a lot of shoes were made that way, and then the leather is stretched around the last. And then depending on the construction technique, how the midsole is attached, or is it a welted, or is it a stitch down, is it a glue-on? You know, there's different possibilities, different characteristics of the different styles. But the fabrication is basically, you know, stretching the leather over a form that looks like a foot,
mm-hmm.
and initially taking some measurements to get the form similar to the foot. And basically you have to make it and then see if it fits.
And then, like, how is it, you mentioned that there's a couple different ways that the sole can be attached to the,
yes,
the upper part of,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
For example, in the sandals that you brought in here today, how is that attached to the sole?
This is totally glued.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of shoes, actually a lot of modern shoes, like a lot of the Chinese shoes, and most athletic shoes, the soles are all glued on under pressure. But traditionally, there is some glue involved. But in the old days, very old days, they were just stitched on.
Oh, really?
Stitched down around the outside, yeah, before the glues were perfected.
Yeah.
But these days, it's like a two-part contact cement, so things stick.
Yeah, and then, like, after a long time wearing the shoes, when the sole starts to peel off, it's just because that glue has worn away or something?
Yeah, yeah. Or a lot of the glues aren't, they're moisture resistant, but they're not, like, totally water resistant. So that's where a lot of the stitching helps as well, because you actually have a physical, lock stitch helps it, keeps it together as well as the glue. It's like a reinforcement.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. So how would you suggest someone, you know, if someone has no sewing experience, they've never, you know, picked up a needle, what's a good way for them to kind of, like, start to learn how to sew?
Pick up a needle and thread before you even get to a sewing machine.
Mm-hmm.
And you can play with it, you know. Traditionally, the soles of shoes were sewn on with one thread, with a needle at both ends. So you put the thread through the hole, and then as you go, you would go through the hole one way and through the hole the other way with the needles and pull them. So that's basically forming a human lock stitch.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what the machine is doing. And depending on what you want to sew, you know, that's for more heavy duty. A lot of leather work is done that way. Even today, a lot of harness hand stitching is done that way. It's called a cobbler stitch.
That's neat. How big are those needles, though? They got to be kind of heavy duty, right?
Depending on the thread size,
oh, that's
as
point.
Well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of the threads can be, well, the different numbers, you know, wouldn't mean much to people on the radio, but everything from, you know, really fine thread to a heavy duty thread that's almost an eighth inch in diameter, and the eye of the needle has to accommodate that the size of the
right.
thread. So it depends. You know, there isn't a one size fits all.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what's, like, a good beginner sewing project?
Good question. A pillow, probably.
Okay, like just a nice like rectangle.
Yeah,
square.
Yeah, yeah. As far as a leather project, I don't know. Maybe maybe a bracelet, something small.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the easiest thing to play with at first.
And what are the different? If we're speaking about leather. What are the different stitches involved? Is there different types of hand stitches?
There's a myriad. It's almost like braiding. Different kind of braiding, different kinds of knots. A lot of the cowboy people have taken it to a high art. And I'm sure if you did a Google search for leather braiding, you'd find all different kinds of patterns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had to repair a couple different things with different braiding patterns, and it's real challenging.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, when there's, like, eight different strands, and which one goes over which one, and which one goes backwards, and how to copy it, and it's real challenging. So I'm going to stick to the shoes.
Yeah, right. Stay away from the braiding.
Right. But that's a whole other specialty.
Yeah, so what are your future plans for basic sewing? It's a long-term vision.
At this point, I'm hoping to expand my shop space. Because right now I have a room in my house dedicated to my sewing machines. And I'm doing a lot of the gluing and finishing outside, which these days is nice because the weather is nice. But the rain the other night kind of gave me a little wake-up call that, you know, luckily I had everything covered. But the days of working outside are numbered.
Mm-hmm.
So I have plans in my yard to expand into another little building about another 10 by 10 feet.
Oh, nice.
And that'll be hoping that'll get me through the winter. And by then, I'm hoping to have a couple different shoes, you know, to wear and to show people and hopefully get some orders.
That's excellent. I mean, I think the custom shoes is just, there's not many people doing that.
Right. Well, the people that are doing it, it's really high-end stuff, which and their work is beautiful. I mean, no doubt about it. But it's, to me, I don't know, a couple $100 pair of custom shoes that fit you, that you like, you know, that you want to wear all the time. They're not like showpieces that you're afraid to wear anywhere.
Right, yeah.
And some of the high-end shoes, to me, they're like works of art. They should be framed and put on the wall or something.
Well, and like the other thing, too, is I think nowadays we have this idea that like you buy a pair of shoes, eventually they wear out, you throw them away.
Mm-hmm.
But with a handmade pair of shoes, you can repair them, right?
Oh, you can definitely repair them, and I think you almost have more invested in the whole interaction between the shoemaker and the person ordering them. You know, I definitely got that with these sandals, talking to the client, and they're actually overdue. So I had to just, like, eat some crow and just tell them, hey, they're on their way, and it's a process. It's not an event. It's not like I'm a human and other things have come up.
Right.
So it's part of that relationship. That's the thing. It's like a relationship, a human relationship. It's not just a factory or not just going to a store and buying something. There's actually a human behind, you know, the product.
Right, which I think is really important you know, kind of on the customer education level for them to understand that.
Definitely, definitely. And a lot of people do understand that these days. They've been educated and they realize what's involved. Mm-hmm. You know, that's part of it, is you have to educate the consumer as to what's involved in the product. And I think once they do that, once you can do that successfully, you know, you have a relationship that you can build on. And that's, I don't know if that's my business model, but that would work.
Yeah, you're like, oh, that seems like a good idea.
Yeah.
Do you have any words of wisdom for someone that wants to turn their sewing hobby into a business?
Persevere, you know, and get some feedback from your friends or from other people. And be on the lookout. You know, when I'm going somewhere, I look at people's shoes or I look in a store and see how things are designed. At one point, I ordered a pair of boots from a bootmaker in Oregon, and I went to Oregon for a week to watch him make my boots. And then about a week or two later, there was a show in Oregon that I went to, and I saw this guy walking toward me, and I recognized the boots. So I knew they were from this guy. I didn't realize it was the guy that had mentored me, because I hadn't looked at his face. I just looked at his boots.
Oh, my gosh, that's too funny.
So,
and he's all so, like, don't you remember
I know,
me?
Yeah. Exactly.
How are you? So what's the best way for the public to get in contact with you?
Shoot me an email, steve@basicsewing.com, and basic as three S's, BASSIC sewing.com.
Excellent. Well, Steve, it's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Andrea. It's been my pleasure. I was last on KSBY playing music on Cheryl LaTamura's show maybe 10 or 15 years ago, so it's nice to be back.
Welcome back.
Yes, thank
and
you.
And you'll have to come on sooner than 10 years from the next
please.
Time. We'll also have your contact info listed on our website, Quarter Acre Farm.